Some years ago, Eric Weiner suffered abdominal pain. The writer and former NPR correspondent ended up in the emergency room.
And this nurse walks in, and she sees I'm scared. I mean, I was just reeking of fear. And she bends over to draw blood or something like that, and she whispers in my ear these words I will never forget. She said, "Have you found your God yet?"
Doctors eventually found nothing wrong with Eric Weiner, but the nurse's question about finding God made him wonder if something really was wrong. He'd previously written a book called Geography of Bliss about a hunt for happiness, and now Weiner began another quest to find religion. He wrote a book on his experience called Man Seeks God, and he came by our studios to talk about it. You had this prompt to explore your own faith and try to find out what it was, but you grew up Jewish. Why not just go in that direction, go a little more deeply in that direction?
Well, I grew up as a very specific kind of Jew, Steve. I grew up as a gastronomical Jew, which is basically bagels, lox, gefilte fish. You know, if it were edible, then it was Jewish and supposedly had something to do with God. I'm really not kidding. And you're right, I could stick with my heritage, but it just struck me as that was a bit of a cop-out. If I was going to answer this nurse's question, then I needed to look as broadly as possible.
Now, as a Jew, you went first naturally to Islam.
I dove headfirst into Islam for a couple of reasons. One is that this is the 800-pound God in the room, right? I mean, everyone has an opinion about Islam, even if they don't express it. But I couldn't look at all of Islam. As you know, it's this huge religion that spans many sects and many regions. So I chose the one that appealed to me the most, and that's the Sufis, the mystical sect of Islam.
In the end, Sufism didn't seem to sway you. It wasn't the end of your quest, in any case.
It was not the end, but I have to say I loved whirling like a dervish. I took lessons in whirling.
How does one whirl like a dervish, if you can describe that on the radio?
Well, very carefully, it turns out. It's not really a dance. It's a spiritual activity.
Are you actually whirling? You're spinning like a figure skater on one toe?
Yes, you are in one place, and the really serious dervishes will practice on a nail so that their foot stays put on that nail as they whirl. I didn't do that. But the idea is that it's prayer in motion as you're turning. You're sort of praying. You're in what they call zikr, or remembrance of God. They say if you're close to God, you don't get dizzy. I nearly lost it. I was so not dizzy. So I guess I have work to do. But I did, for that briefest of moments, experience what it felt like to turn effortlessly. And then, of course, I announced to everyone who was watching me, "Look, I'm turning. It's amazing." And then promptly nearly fell over.
Oh, it's the being conscious of yourself that caused you to do that.
Well, Rumi, the great Sufi poet, said, "Never analyze enthusiasm." And I made that mistake.
So you continue further east, get into other religions. You end up in Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal.
I do. I was diving into Tibetan Buddhism. There were several hundred thousand Tibetan Buddhists in Kathmandu. And I was seriously in search of a lama to teach me Buddhist meditation. And I was looking, and I couldn't find one. And finally, someone suggested to me, "Have you considered Wayne?" And I'm thinking, well, which part of Tibet is Wayne from? And they said, "Oh, the Staten Island part." So I'm thinking, well, this isn't really why I flew to Kathmandu. But it turns out that Wayne of Staten Island had been living in Kathmandu for 30 years. He was an accomplished Buddhist and meditator, and I agreed to work with Wayne. So every morning we would climb up onto his roof in Kathmandu with the Himalayas in the background, and I would attempt to still my monkey mind, as the Buddhists call it, this tendency for our minds to dart around and to never stay in one place.
So you're not whirling this time, you're trying to be still.
Well, my mind is whirling, but I'm still.
Okay.
And we worked at it and worked at it, and I'm sitting there and I'm trying to just watch my breath. And this worked for about 3 seconds. And then my mind starts to obsess about, for some reason, nail clippers. I didn't bring any with me. And I become concerned. I mean, seriously concerned that my nails will grow to these sort of Howard Hughes-esque proportions, that there are no nail clippers in all of Kathmandu.
So as soon as you try to empty your mind, random anxieties fill up that space right away. That's what happened to you.
Things, and this is what I discovered on the spiritual journey, is that things often get worse before they get better.
Why do you write, Eric Weiner, that as you explored more and more religions, you actually became more depressed?
I think it's what's known as a karmic reckoning. This idea, you know, that as you dive into this stuff, you're really familiarizing yourself with your mind, the Buddhists would say, with your heart, the Sufis would say, with God, the Christians would say. You know, it's like ripping off the bandage and you realize there's this gaping wound on your arm or in your chest. And you're like, oh, my God, I've got a terrible wound there. And then ideally, as you go about a spiritual practice, you start to do something about it.
Did things get any easier when you went to New York City to spend time with Franciscan friars?
Yes and no. Easier in that I was on my home turf now, on more familiar terrain in the sense that it's Christianity. And that comes fully loaded in its own way. Sitting in Catholic Mass as a Jew, a gastronomical Jew, but still a Jew, attempting to cross myself and just doing it all wrong, and my arms are flailing every which way. But, you know, living cheek by jowl with them, as I did for a while, I saw what good work they did running a homeless shelter in the South Bronx. And they've taken these vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Now, I've experienced two of those, chastity and poverty, in my life, but never voluntarily. And here they've taken a vow for all three, but they never felt in denial. You know, I would ask them, you know, wouldn't you rather have the latest iPhone? Or, you know, I just had this impression that they woke up every day really having to suppress these basic human needs for things like sex and stuff. And they were not like that at all. They had made a choice. And they felt basically that by having, say, no stuff, they didn't have stuff to worry about. They didn't have to worry about upgrading to stuff 2.0 or people stealing their stuff. In a way, it's very liberating.
Let me ask about your own journey then, Eric Weiner. As you go along through these various religious practices, you say at one point when you're being asked to believe something, my disbelief refused to suspend itself.
Right.
Did you end up, in the end, with something to hold on to?
No, I didn't. I'm sort of holding on to a lot of things at once. I think it is possible to create a sort of IKEA God, some assembly required, you know, this idea that you can cobble together your sort of own personal religion, a sort of mixtape of God. What I conclude is you need a foundation. And in my case, that is Judaism. I did come back to the spiritual aspect of Judaism, Kabbalah, and find that I need that foundation. But on top of that foundation, you can add all kinds of things. So I'm sort of in perpetual seeker mode, but I think that's okay.
Eric Weiner is the author of Man Seeks God. Author of Man Seeks God. Thanks very much for coming by, Eric.
Thanks so much, Steve.
The British mystery writer P.D. James is best known for her creation, Adam Dogleish. The Scotland Yard detective is pensive and private, shaped by his own personal tragedy. He populates many of P.D. James's stories, but not her latest. In her new book, P.D. James inhabits the world of Jane Austen, specifically Pride and Prejudice. Death Comes to Pemberley picks up with Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy married and settled into Darcy's ancestral home. But as the name suggests, it's not quite happily ever after. I asked P.D. James why she decided to bring death to Pemberley.
I had this idea at the back of my mind that I'd like to combine my two great enthusiasms. One is for the novels of Jane Austen, and the second is for writing detective fiction. And it would be rather fun to marry them and set a book in Pemberley, 6 years after Elizabeth and Darcy had married, when everything is going very well and they're very happy and they have two healthy and handsome boys in the nursery, and life is peaceful and ordered and, of course, rich and prosperous. And then comes the eruption of a rather ghastly murder in the Pemberley woodlands.
Well, I wonder if you were at all inspired by these, well, popular sequels, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, or Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters?
No. I hate to tell you, Linda, that I didn't even know they existed. And when I know it's absolutely true. And when I'd started, I said to my PA, would she look on the internet and find the computer? She does all these clever things, which I don't do, and see how many other people had written sequels. And we were amazed, absolutely amazed. And when we read some of the contents, well, I think they certainly should apologize to Jane Austen. I have tried to be very true to her characters and very true, as far as I can be, to the style of the book.
Well, now, you have kept the Pride and Prejudice cast of characters, although some are way in the background. But I was very pleased to see that the villain in your book is also Jane Austen's villain, the notorious Mr. Wickham.
Yes, I suppose we ought not really to let that be known. But indeed, I think everybody does know that he is the villain. But the great problem is, of course, will he escape being executed? So this is a great grief, because both Darcy and Elizabeth know that if this happened, there would be a terrible cloud over their marriage and over, indeed, their whole family.
Now, Jane and Fitzwilliam Darcy, on the eve of their famous annual ball, which is a major event in the county,
yes,
they learn that a murder has been committed on the grounds of their estate. In fact, Darcy discovers Wickham bending over the bloody body of the victim. So Darcy has an important role to play.
He has a very important part, and he believes Wickham to be innocent of this particular crime. But, of course, because Wickham is his brother-in-law, he feels a responsibility. Wickham, the hated Wickham, the Wickham who's done so much harm to him, has by this marriage come into the family, and he's faced with the awful possibility that he will be a witness for the prosecution in the trial.
You know, Elizabeth remains, although she's very much aware of her position in the county and so forth, she does remain a fairly spicy character in your book.
Yes, she does.
And she seems to kind of be reconsidering her attraction to Darcy and to acknowledge that perhaps she had been fairly calculating about it. You write in your book, Elizabeth knew she was not formed for the sad contrivances of poverty.
Yes. I don't think she married for money. Elizabeth did marry for love. I think she did love Darcy, and she grew to love him more. But she was not a woman who would allow herself to fall in love with a man who was totally penniless, because she felt she had responsibilities to her family. I think her aunt, her very wise aunt Gardiner, said, "Your father expects you to behave sensibly," and that simply meant to make a satisfactory marriage.
And you also spend some time on just those questions, the very limited choices that women can make in the early 19th century.
Absolutely. I mean, women were expected to marry. And if they didn't marry, that was regarded as a failure. And the only job that they could do outside the home would be going as a governess. And it was a horrible job, because you were neither a servant nor were you the family. And we know how much it was dreaded, you know, from one of Jane Austen's other books, Emma. So marriage was tremendously important. And of course, the women were looking for men with money, but in fact, the men were looking for women with money. Money was, seems to me, tremendously important in Jane Austen.
Now, of course, there is a way in which your book is completely different from anything Austen ever would have attempted. A large portion of the book is a courtroom drama. And you also do spend some time on what they knew at that time about forensics. I mean, there are discussions of what was the cause of death. What could the weapon have been?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Scientific experiments were done by gentlemen, very often with money, in their country houses. This is a general practitioner, a doctor. He is the one that the investigating magistrate, Sir Selwyn Hardcastle, says to him, "I suppose you clever people can't tell us the difference between the blood from one body and the blood from another." And he says, "No, Sir Selwyn, we don't set out to be gods." And it would have seemed incredible to them that that could actually come. And they would have also been amazed, I think, to think that you could say who had last handled the firearm.
Now, I wonder if you have thought about continuing in this vein. I mean, death comes to Donwell Abbey, or death at Delaford, or something.
No, I hadn't at all. And it's interesting, really, Linda, you see, I had never thought that I would ever want to use somebody else's characters. If it hadn't been this idea that I would like to combine a novel which I knew very well and loved, although it's not my favourite Jane Austen one, Emma is, and my passion for writing detective fiction. I think, like most readers of Jane Austen, I often wonder what happens afterwards, because they're so real to us. But no, this will be very much the one-off.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Well, thank you very much for talking to us about Death Comes to Pemberley.
Well, it's been lovely, Linda. It's been great talking to you.
Mystery novelist P.D. James, her latest book is Death Comes to Pemberley.
Lou Beach is an illustrator. You may have seen his fanciful and often surreal graphics in Wired, The New York Times, and Harper's. Maybe you've seen his album covers for groups like Weather Report. And Blink-182. Now Lou Beach is also an author. His book, 420 Characters, comes out Tuesday. Here's one of his stories, read by actor Jeff Bridges.
You see, Ray, he was this tenor player, good tone, good hands. He never played with the big guys, but still, he was good. And between sets, Ray would take out some silly putty, you know, that kid stuff, and he'd stretch it and pull it and even make little animals and things. He said it kept his fingers limber. In his pockets, he'd carry three or four of those plastic eggs the stuff came in. That's how he come to have the nickname, The Hen.
And that's the whole story, 420 characters worth. Author Lou Beach joins us from the studios of NPR West. Lou Beach, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Audie. Thank you.
Now, the title of your book, 420 Characters, refers to the character limit for Facebook status updates. And you started posting these vignettes on your page in 2009. What compelled you to start doing this?
Boredom. I was bored with what I was reading from other people's status updates, and I was bored with my own. You know, they just dealt with everyday situations, and I thought it would be an interesting place to teach myself how to write. I'd always had dreams of being a writer, and this seemed like a great place to exercise. The limit made it not so daunting, the 420 limit. The funny thing is that shortly after the book came out, Facebook up the limit to 5,000 characters.
Oh.
So I'm not as crazed about making them fit anymore.
At the same time, though, you were posting these every day on Facebook, which to me sounds daunting. How did you discipline yourself to do that?
I don't know if there's any discipline involved. They come out of a dream state in the morning just before I wake. They're like the tail end of a dream, and then I fool around with them a bit, and then I go to the computer and I type them out and then use the word count tool to see if I've fallen within the 420 confines.
The raven sways in the wind at the very top of the pine, a lone black pennant.
There are some famous voices we hear delivering the stories on your website, actors Jeff Bridges and Ian McShane and Dave Alvin from the Blasters. How'd they get involved?
Well, they're all old friends of mine, and they were kind enough to let me ride their coattails.
I'm alone on deck, sharing a smoke with myself. There's no moon, but the stars are a city in the sky.
You know, I'll see somebody walking down the street and I'll notice something about him that's interesting, and then I'll go home and think about it. And then hopefully in the morning something will evolve from that, or I'll hear a snippet of conversation or see something on TV. Because I'm a collage artist in my visual work, this is sort of the same way, the process of taking bits and pieces and putting them together until a narrative forms.
Are any of the stories actually related?
Maybe in a general thematic way, you know, the cowboy stories and the criminal stories. There are a couple that actually were pieces of, I tried to do a serial story. So every couple of days I'd post a story about these two characters. And online, there's a character named Ronnie, who's a ne'er-do-well, and I get a lot of responses to a Ronnie story. Oh, no, it's Ronnie again. Oh, that bad Ronnie. And then there's Jerome, who's a hapless office worker. But otherwise, you know, they're just sort of general thematic things that I keep going to for some reason. You know, the river, the ocean, mountains, the West.
I don't know if you have the book with you, but is there one in particular that you like?
Oh, now you put me on the spot. Let me, okay, here's a poignant little one. She was beautiful, fragile and afraid, a peacock in a hailstorm. We sat together on the couch, waiting for the car horn. It sounded at last, and I held her hand as we pushed through the snow in the driveway. I turned away after I buckled her into the back seat. Don wouldn't look at me, but reached back, touched her knee. I watched them drive off, then walk back to the house, careful not to step into her footprints.
I don't mean to put you on the spot. I think it's just miraculous that you're like, I'm going to give writing a shot on Facebook, and they turn into, like, poetry. I mean, if this is your first outing.
I am as shocked as you are. I'm so overwhelmed with the amount of attention that the book has gotten. You know, I feel like the short guy who's wandered into a pickup basketball game with guys who are 7 feet tall and got the ball somehow and made a basket. It's really miraculous.
Illustrator and author Lou Beach, his debut book of short stories, 420 Characters, comes out on Tuesday. He joined us from the studios of NPR West. Lou Beach, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Audie. It was a pleasure.
You can read some stories from 420 Characters on our website, npr.org. Sometimes the stories of life's biggest triumphs and tragedies are best told not in the headlines or in a cable news crawl, but in literature. In her novel, Salvage the Bones, Jesmyn Ward tells the story of how one family on the Mississippi Gulf Coast endured Hurricane Katrina. But it also tells the story of what they were enduring before the storm: extreme poverty, sexual abuse, routine violence, and survival. It's all seen through the eyes of the 15-year-old narrator named Esh. Salvage the Bones recently won the National Book Award for Fiction, and Jesmyn Ward joins us now. Welcome, and congratulations on this really significant honor.
Thank you very much.
What about the award? I'm told that you were very surprised. That you were surprised. You were so surprised that you almost couldn't talk.
I was. I did not think that I was going to win. I'm very hesitant to assume that good things are going to come to me. So beforehand, I kept preparing myself for losing, you know, and I thought, well, I will prepare myself to be happy for whoever wins and clap.
But did you think that you were a, God, I hate the term dark horse, but I'll use it just for now.
Underdog?
Underdog, thank you. Because of the subject matter? Do you think that the subject matter you thought was just too gritty?
I thought that the subject matter was too gritty, and I thought that the people that I write about and the place that I write about, you know, where they come from, these aren't popular, I guess, with a lot of, you know, readers. Because of that, I didn't expect to win. And then also because I wasn't that well known, and the book wasn't, it was out there, but it wasn't out there.
I hear what you're saying. But let's talk about the book. It is beautifully written, but it's also got, it's a tough read. I don't think that there's any question about that. It deals with subjects that, as you said, are often not dealt with in literature. One of them is dogfighting. It opens with a very graphic scene of a pit bull giving birth. Why did you start that way?
Well, I'd had Esh's character in my head for a while, and I knew that I wanted to write a novel about her, about a girl that grows up in a world full of men. I'd also had Skeeta, who's her brother. I'd had his character in my head for a while, but the relationship between Skeeta and his dog fascinated me so. Like, that's where a lot of the heat was for me.
Well, and then, let me stop you there. You know what's fascinating to me? I don't know if you mind my drawing this analogy. In a way, China, who is the dog, and Esh have parallel lives because they are both loved in their way, but they are used each in their own way. And that's one of the things that I think many people might find puzzling. I mean, Skeeta loves the dog, but he doesn't mind using her to fight. But Esh, one of the very disturbing aspects of the novel is that she is used sexually by many of the young men around her. And she describes this in this very detached way. Do you mind if I ask, where did this come from? And I hope you don't mind if I ask whether this was part of your own experience?
No, it wasn't. But I think when I was growing up, I knew girls like Esh who approached sex in that way. When I thought about her character, in a way, it's almost like she's mirroring the attitudes of the young men around her in the way that she thinks about it, right? And in the way that she sort of separates it from herself. And it's something that she does, and it's not connected to who she is, or she doesn't think that it is. I saw it a lot when I was growing up. You know, sex was just something that you did. And from a very young age, you know, for Esh, it's something that you're sort of not that informed about or not that sort of lucid throughout, I guess, which is in a way why I think that she, at the beginning of the book, she finds that she's pregnant because, you know, she is so detached from what's happening that I don't think she's thinking about, like, the ramifications of, you know, of what could happen.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Jesmyn Ward. She is the winner of the 2011 National Book Award for Fiction for her novel Salvage the Bones. It describes one family's journey on the Mississippi coast and how they endured Hurricane Katrina. In fact, it describes the days leading up to Hurricane Katrina. Do you mind if I ask you to read just a piece, a little passage, so people can hear your beautiful words?
Okay, so I'll read a very short passage from the beginning of the 12th chapter, the 12th day, alive. We sat in the open attic until the wind quieted from jet fighter planes to coughing puffs. We sat in the open attic until the sky brightened from a sick orange to a clean white gray. We sat in the open attic until the water, which had milled like a boiling soup beneath us, receded inch by inch back into the woods. We sat in the open attic until the rain eased to drips. We sat in the open attic until we got cold and the light wind that blew chilled us. We huddled together in Mother Lisbeth's attic and tried to rub heat from each other, but couldn't. We were a pile of wet, cold branches, human debris in the middle of all the rest of it.
As I think anybody can hear, even just from that very brief excerpt, the writing is lovely. But I have to ask the question that artists are asked when they take on subjects like this. And in fact, you said in your remarks after winning the award, you said that you wanted to write about the poor black rural people of the South who've so often been marginalized, who kind of live in this parallel universe that nobody else knows anything about. But then people say, okay, that's on the one hand. On the other hand, could one argue that this is kind of its own poverty porn? You know, it's like you're exposing people's lives in a way that perpetuates the stereotypes of people just ignorant, passive observers in their own lives. You know, just living really in a litany of sorrows. How do you react to that?
I get angry because this is the truth, you know? Like, this is the reality for so many people where I come from. And it was the reality for me for a portion of my life. At one time when I was 8 years old, my mother and father, my brother and my sisters, we had to move back in with my grandmother. And there were 13 of us living in one house. Like, some of the aspects of this, of the poverty that these characters experience, like, that's real. I can't deny telling that truth. When I write, one of the things that I'm really attempting to do is I'm attempting to humanize my characters. I feel a lot of pressure when I'm writing because I know, you know, if they looked at a synopsis of the book, what they read could only confirm all the stereotypes that they have about us and about people like us. But I want to make us so human and make our stories so powerful and so touching so that the reader will empathize with those characters. That larger story in Salvage the Bones is just about survival. And I think that in the end that there are things about this novel and about these characters' experiences that make their stories universal stories.
Hmm. Well, congratulations once again on this great honor and recognition for this work. But so what's next for you?
I just handed in a memoir about a very specific time in my life when 5 young black men that I know died. And the first was my brother, who was hit by a drunk driver.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Because I think that when people hear about epidemics like that of young black men dying, that they think about urban areas, and they don't think about places like the place that I'm from, these small, you know, rural areas in the South. And so in the book, I'm writing about the five young men, and I'm writing about their lives, right? And so I'm asking the question of, like, why an epidemic like that would happen.
Well, hopefully you'll come back and tell us more about that one. I hope you will.
I'd love to.
Jesmyne Ward is the winner of the 2011 National Book Award for Fiction. She won for her latest novel, Salvage the Bones. She joined us from member station WWNO in New Orleans. Jesmyne, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
There is an ironic twist to the publication of John Lewis Gaddis's new biography of George F. Kennan. For decades, Kennan was America's most famous diplomat, the country's top Russia scholar, the author of the Cold War-era policy of containment of the Soviet Union. Even in retirement, when Kennan spoke, ambassadors and secretaries of state trembled and rushed to do damage control. Professor Gaddis, who is a Yale historian of the Cold War, had access to Kennan's diaries, even a dream diary, and the agreement was to publish after Kennan's death. Kennan lived to be 101. He died in 2005, and that's the irony. By the time Gaddis's book, George F. Kennan, An American Life, came out last month, Kennan, a man who for so many years needed no introduction, had become someone unfamiliar to a generation of American readers. Now, Professor Gaddis, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert.
And for the benefit of younger listeners, by that I mean, say, people under 40, in a nutshell, who is George F. Kennan?
Well, if you had to single out one individual who probably did more than anyone else in coming up with the big idea of how the second half of the 20th century could be less dangerous than the first half was, I think Kennan would be right up there at the top of the list.
Yes, we should explain that containment may have been decried from the left as a policy that provoked the Soviet Union into a Cold War that might have been avoided. And from the right, it was something far short of what was really needed, liberation of nations held captive to communism. But really, after the Second World War, this was a way of saying the U.S. doesn't have to give in to Stalin and Moscow and everything, and that doesn't mean we have to have World War III.
That's correct. Within the context of the end of World War II, when we went through this abrupt transition of the Soviet Union having been our glorious ally and then suddenly emerging as an unexpected adversary, many people did see only two choices, and one was World War III, and the other was appeasement of the kind that had indeed led to World War II. So what Kennan showed was the middle path between those two extremes.
And if the U.S. took that middle path, as Kennan saw it, it would not respond to every Soviet or every communist advance in the same way. It would decide, where should we check Stalin's advances? Where is it worth it? Where can we succeed?
I think that's right. We had to decide in our own minds, as Kennan saw it, first of all, what was important to our security, and he did not believe that maintaining some kind of a global military presence was that important. But he also had a second idea, and this was that Stalin, although he is a totalitarian, he's not Hitler. He does not have some kind of fixed timetable for aggression. And so if you put these two things together and then add one third component, which is the illogic of the Soviet system, Kennan was arguing there was time. If you could be patient, the Cold War could eventually end peacefully. And really, to a remarkable extent, yeah, in 1946, 1947, he sees how it ends in 1989-91.
Now, I want to play you something that George Kennan said on NPR in 1993, when he was already pushing 90. He was despairing of the influence of politics on the making of foreign policy during, as he said, during 26 years in the Foreign Service.
We were supposed to be acting in the national interest and to report to our government, to inform our government as to where the national interest was with relation to given countries. And for that reason, it's been very hard for many of us who are in the career to forgive our government for its flaccidity and its weakness in the face of special political interests.
What are you hearing there?
Well, I hear someone who is in very good shape as he's pushing 90. But I hear something else that was a major theme in George's life, which was his extreme distrust of democracy. It's paradoxical because history will regard him, I think, as one of the greatest defenders of democracy for the containment strategy But George himself was extremely impatient with democracy because he saw it as interfering with the kind of precise thought that would be necessary to conduct an intelligent foreign policy.
He seems also to have despaired of American consumerism, American highways, automobile traffic, American big city life, American culture, and generally Americans.
I think it's fair to say that George Kennan holds some kind of record for despair. He was never comfortable with what he was doing, particularly if it involved his own country and his own culture. But I think what he tried to do was to hold America to impossibly high standards.
Professor Geddes, one of the most appealing and impressive things about George Kennan, as he emerges from your biography, is that his approach to foreign policy analysis went way beyond smart and even creative. He was imaginative. He wrote like a novelist. He wrote poetry very often. Mm-hmm. And he thought you could understand Russia better by reading Chekhov and Dostoevsky than by reading Marx and Lenin.
Absolutely. He drew enormous influence from Russian novelists and writers of the 19th century. So Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and especially Chekhov. George regarded himself in the end as a failure in life because he never completed his biography of Chekhov, and that's what he really wanted to do.
He was a very tormented soul in many ways. He seems to be a man who was programmed to feel that he wasn't doing good enough.
Well, I think you're right on target, and this is partly a Calvinist upbringing in Milwaukee. But I think the real key to it is something that he mentioned to me the very first time we talked about the biography. He said, you have to understand that it's very important that my mother died 2 months after I was born and that I was scarred for life by not having a mother. And I think that's the key to understanding much of his inner torment.
I'm trying to understand the arrangement with George Kennan that this book be published posthumously. That was something that you worked out. You worked out many decades ago.
Yes, we did.
How old was George Kennan when he said, okay, but wait till I'm dead?
George was 78. I was 40. We both felt strongly that the only way that you can write a good biography is to write it with the guarantee the subject of the biography will not read it. The only thing that surprised us both when we made this deal in 1978 was that we thought it would be coming out at some point, surely in the next decade or so. And it never occurred to either of us that he would live for 30 more years. And of course, George, being George, regarded his longevity as a grave personal failing. So I would repeatedly, in the last 20 years or so, get phone calls in which he would apologize profusely for living and thereby delaying the biography.
I have to say that since nearly every chapter seems to include a hospitalization or a serious illness, the notion that he would break 100 is not entirely obvious, or wouldn't
it
be obvious.
It is not entirely obvious, not at all. And yet he was a pretty robust character in the long run.
Well, Professor Geddes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
That's a Professor John Lewis Geddes of Yale University. He is the author of George F. Kennan, An American Life.
This is NPR News.